Want to hear something amazing? Discover matches all the cash back you earn on your credit card at the end of your first year, automatically, dollar for dollar, with no limit on how much you can earn. Extra cash? Come on, how amazing is that? In fact, it's even more amazing when you realize all the places where Discover is accepted. 99% of places in the U.S. that take credit cards. So when it comes to Discover, get used to hearing yes more often. Learn more at discover.com/yes. 2020 Nielsen Report limitations apply. Want to hear something amazing? Discover matches all the cash back you earn on your credit card at the end of your first year, automatically, dollar for dollar, with no limit on how much you can earn. Extra cash? Come on, how amazing is that? In fact, it's even more amazing when you realize all the places where Discover is accepted. 99% of places in the U.S. that take credit cards. So when it comes to Discover, get used to hearing yes more often. Learn more at discover.com/yes. 2020 Nielsen Report limitations apply.
Hello, everybody. Recording live from somewhere.
Lord of the mercy. All night, Sunday, Central. Follow me now. Listen. Say hi, Dick. Yes, you're rolling hip-hop. Say J-Roll.
Hello and welcome to the Rapcast. I'm Miro Sampson Folk, and today, a departure from the usual conversations around these parts. We're going to talk about basketball and the Premier League and soccer at large, comparing and contrasting the two things. I'm joined by two guests today, so a three-man podcast. One of them, the OG of Raptors Republic, Zarar Siddiqui, and another, Tosin, also known as Nigerian Scams on Twitter. And he's also the host of the Shirtless Plantain Show, which you can catch on YouTube. Guys, and we'll start with Zarar. How you doing, man?
Good, man. I'm still basking in the championship glow, which I expect to last, another couple of decades.
Well, today is the 5-week, I guess, anniversary, right?
Yeah, it's lost in the mix when you're thinking in terms of decades, man. 5 weeks is nothing.
Yeah, exactly. Tosin, how you doing, man?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Just been watching way too much soccer this summer. I didn't even know that was possible, but yeah, just been watching way too much.
How do you feel about the Super Eagles this year? I know you wrote about it, but maybe reiterate it for this show.
It's a journey, because I literally watched Nigeria my whole life, and I think about like after the 2002 World Cup, we were just bad. So just to see kind of where we are from like 2002 up to like 2014 till now, there's been a major progress. And a lot of people don't really watch Nigeria like that. They just kind of just watching it. We have tournaments. I'm literally watching, like, I've watched a Nigeria game on, like, a shoddy Facebook stream of somebody in the stadium. So it's like I've been always watching these guys, and just to see their progress is amazing. So, you know, it's a work in progress, really. We just have a bunch of young talent. It's just, like, getting it right at the end of the day. So just kind of excited for the future, but kind of disappointed at the same time that we didn't go to the final. But
the first question I would think, and this is just off the dome, I'm kind of interested what your response would be. Mm-hmm. Raptors fans might have to grapple with the exit of Kyle Lowry. You're just waxing poetic about how big a fan you are of Nigeria's team. Yeah. And John Obi Mikel.
He's a legend. I mean, I already knew this was going to be his last tournament. You could kind of see, even when he played in the World Cup last year, like, he's just on his last legs. But one thing I love about him, that he knows that, like, there's a bunch of young talent coming up, and there's no point of staying, like, you know, overstaying your welcome. Like, you know, at some point, it's just time to go. So he's a legend for that. And, like, just even just everything that he's done, like, he, I feel, if he grew up with this current Nigerian generation, you would have seen how great he really could have been with this team. But he's done well. He's done really, really well.
And then I guess to flip it directly into a basketball contrast and comparing thing, you were saying that if he fit in with this team, if he was the same age, you'd really get to see him shine. Yeah. But he didn't get to. Is there an heir apparent to him in the squad right now, maybe in the youth squad? And then also, from an outsider's perspective, you're obviously not a Raptors fan. Yeah. Who do you think is the heir apparent, if there is one, to Kyle Lowry on the Raptors?
For Nigeria, there's literally, I could give you maybe like 10 to 15 different kids that, like, A, either aren't eligible to play for Nigeria right now. Nigeria have to, like, get them to, like, switch their allegiance. Or they're, like, just waiting. Like, we have a kid named Kelechi Nkwali who played with the youth team. He's supposed to be up next, but the problem is he's at Arsenal, and he's not going to make it at Arsenal, so he just needs to, like, figure out where he's going to play. Since we have a bunch of other young talent, with the Raptors, I would say, like, somebody that you guys, like, because what I see with Kyle Lowry is, because my girlfriend, she's a Raptors fan, so I'm very privy to like knowing what's going on with you guys. So one of the things that I would say is that Kyle Lowry is really loved by you guys, and I feel like he's underrated in a sense by everybody else, because I feel like nobody really watches you guys on a day-to-day basis. So when people saw how well he was doing, it was just like, you guys like, well, that's what he does on a normal basis. That's like what we see. I'll say somebody who's kind of loved like that would be probably Pascal. I think that he would kind of be like the cornerstone for you guys going, like, you know, for the next, you know, for the next couple of years. So I think that he will kind of be like that kind of like cornerstone of your team. And like, he'd be like the face of the Raptors in a sense.
Zarar, I'm going to swing the first real question to you. And I've always thought for the last little while that one of the most intriguing conversations around the NBA right now, and it's something that Kevin Arnovitz, Zach Lowe talked about recently, is the fanfare around transactions and the minimizing of a great deal of games, like regular season games that seemingly have no importance, some playoff games that are lost in memory. And there was also a lot of fake insiders this summer for the NBA, which I think also mirrors the crazy rumor mill around a lot of star soccer players. Have you noticed a change in how fans interact with the rumor mill in either the NBA or soccer? And if so, how have they changed and grown?
Well, I think there's a couple of questions in there. Like one being like what the extra games that seem to happen in the NBA that don't matter, and the second is the rumor mill and the media. So in terms of the extra games, I think I've long been a fan, and I've talked about this for, you know, I've sprinkled this into the Rapcast over several years, is that I really feel to make the regular season more meaningful, we can still play 82 games, but we don't need 82 games to decide playoff seeding. What we should be doing is having a secondary competition in the NBA, much like they do in every other European league, where you have your league system and then you have a secondary cup. Or sometimes a third cup even. I feel that if the NBA just switched to like one home game and one away game and played like a whatever, you know, a 56 game schedule or 58 game schedule, the remaining games, because you know everybody's got to make money on this thing, so you can't just drop games. The remaining games could be structured in a way where it's a secondary competition, and you have a champion of some sort, which is different than the NBA champion. So I always thought that would make the league more interesting, and maybe people would give a shit more about the league. Soccer also has this thing where the league system, every game matters, right? Every game is 3 points, or you draw, you get 1 point. That gives a sense of urgency and excitement and meaning to every game. And that's something the NBA has never been able to say. Same with hockey, for that matter. So that's always been kind of like my take on the extra games. As far as the media goes, yes, there definitely have been a lot more... what's that Chris Broussard type moments here where everybody's trying to pretend to be an insider? I'm not really on Twitter, so I'm sure there's a lot more going on than just Chris Broussard, but I just do, you know, I do check on his timeline sometimes just to make fun of him. Yes, there have been a lot more like fake rumors, but I just don't think it's anywhere close to what happens in Europe, especially if you're talking about England. Like if you focus more on England, like there are newspapers just built for fake rumors, like Express, the Daily Express, the Daily Mirror, half of their stuff is garbage, and people almost read it as a tabloid. They don't expect it to be true. And I think that's the difference in mentality between NBA fans and soccer fans, is that soccer fans sometimes read a newspaper knowing fully well it's garbage. And NBA fans expect the media to be generally more accurate in their reporting. Maybe the tide shifted this year with all the BS stuff, and even Woj getting some stuff wrong. But I just don't think, I think the still are two pretty far apart in terms of how fans at least parse the media.
Sassin, let me swing this over to you then. Zarar expressing obviously that the Premier League, how they do it with the Community Shield, you have things outside of the specific Premier League games. Do you agree with that being a better way to mince out who's the best and provide ulterior wins for other places, other teams during a regular season or during the Premier League season? And then also, you growing up, I'm pretty sure you're a Manchester United fan, the tabloid is rampant for that team. How do you feel about reading and watching people cover that team, how that affects the fans' perspective?
So the first part, I mean, I would love to see more kind of like competitions in the NBA, because like it's 82 games a season. And at some point, you know, players just check out. Like, they just don't care anymore. It's like, whatever. Like, we're going to the playoffs. Like, we just check out. Like, look at Draymond. Like, Draymond lost so much weight in the middle of the season because he was just like, oh, well, the playoffs are coming up soon. So it's like, if you kind of give them more incentive or something else to play for instead of just, like, getting to the playoffs, I feel like they'll make it a little bit more fun. But so many, like, different dead games. Like, people look forward to certain games. And no one really looks forward. Like, no one really wants to watch, like, you know, the Raptors versus the, you know, the Hornets. So, like, you know, the Raptors versus the Suns, especially towards the end of the season. So when there's something more incentivized to play, then, you know, fans are going to probably care a little bit more. But as far as Man United, I mean, done this my whole life, basically, being a United fan. So I think it was probably last year, this year, like, I really just started to check. I'm like, you know what? Whatever happens, happens, because this is the biggest team in England and probably the biggest team in the world. So, like, you're always going to get rumors. You're always going to get players linked. And this year alone, we've had, like, over 120 players linked to us. And we've only signed two. So it's just the fans get overeager and they start to, like, get annoyed with the team. And it's just like, look, this is a billion-dollar business. Like, you can't expect them to just sign certain players. And you know how the owners are. The owners have been the same since 2005. So, you know, I feel like a lot of times fans just, they believe the lies. And then the lies, like, start to affect the way they see the team. And they get real negative. It's just like, look, there's nothing you can do about that. United are always going to get rumors. You just have to deal with it and just, you know, take it for what it is.
And maybe just to add to that, I think sometimes, because there are so many constraints in making deals in the NBA, right? I mean, the salary has to match, and there's a salary cap structure, there's a CBA and all that stuff. In soccer, you generally don't have that. I mean, the financial fair play is more or less a joke. So the flexibility in soccer is always there. So when you hear a rumor, in the NBA, when at least I hear rumor, the first thing that comes to mind is like, ah, man, it's going to be tough to, you know, get that working on the ESPN trade checker or get the logistics to match or get the financials to match. In soccer, you don't have to worry about that. When you hear a rumor to, you know, like, I don't know, Sanchez to United, you're like, yeah, totally possible, because it's all about cash.
No, I was going to say, like, you know, the fact that there's no salary cap in soccer and, like, everybody has money now is kind of like, I mean, I won't be shocked if that happens, you know, so.
Let's table that just for a second. I want to ask both you guys about, there's the World Series, the Stanley Cup, the Super Bowl, Larry O.B. Everything about American sport seems to be the one culmination of, like, a winner. Whereas in European sport, there seems to be more options to find a victory and more avenues to find victory. How do you think fans, and I'll go to you first about this, Zarar, how do you think fans would respond with alternate competitions? I know it's more and more things to watch, but it seems like American fans, Canadian fans want the one thing. And if you tried to divide the attention, how do you think the fans would respond to alternate competitions? Would they be invalidated, do you think, by the fandom, because everything is about rings, chips in this sports fandom, like in the Western world?
I don't know is the answer, but I can speculate that whenever you introduce a change like this, I think it's always met, any change anywhere is met with a bunch of skepticism at first. And if something like this was to happen, I'm pretty sure fans be like, what the hell? But then once you actually start, it all depends what it does to the level of play. If the level of play increases in the secondary competition game, then I think fans would be like, okay, now we're seeing some real stuff, and we're getting something at the end of it. If the players, like, basically don't care and just ignore the secondary competition completely, then the fans might ignore it too. I honestly don't know. It just depends on how much you incentivize players to play in games. So load management, for example. I mean, I think that still might happen in a secondary competition, or it might not. Depends on what you get at the end of the secondary competition. You know, if it's, you know, the baseball does something like the home field advantage gets to the All-Star game. So if you tie it back to something greater, or maybe the winner of the secondary competition gets a playoff seat. I'm just spitballing here. You put a big enough prize at the end of it, people will start to care. To give you a soccer analogy, I never cared about the Europa League. You know, I hate the Europa League. It's on Thursday nights. It sucks. It's long. You got to go to, like, Eastern Europe for, like, all these places where you play on hard grounds. But you know what? for the last couple of years, the winner of the Europa League gets to be in the Champions League. And that made a lot of people care about a competition they don't usually care about. How that would translate to North American sports, I don't know, but I would love to find out.
I mean, I completely agree. I feel like once you introduce a change, I mean, even look at, like, we just added VAR to the Premier League. This is going to be the first season we've seen it. You've already seen the backlash of it. Like, people are just like, oh, no, we're going to change the sport. Like, one of the players from Bayern Munich, he's not a fan of VAR. He just says he takes it away. But it's like, when you add change to anything, people are going to be skeptical about it. But I feel like if you make it fun and more incentivized for people, you know, then it'll be fun. You know, people will be willing to accept it. But it's just that I feel like it's such American culture to have that one thing, because it's just like, you know, you win the Super Bowl, but then you won like the other tournaments. So it's just like, who else is the winner? You know, I feel like that's just kind of ingrained into like American cultures. Like, been doing that literally since the beginning of all these leagues. So it was going to be such a different change for them.
That's why I was wondering, is it's that trump card. It's that you invalidate every other thing. It's why Chris Paul is seen as a loser, because his great games were in the first and second rounds, but he's never won a chip. So everything else is invalidated. We love Kyrie Irving, even though he's kind of in the doldrums. He's not doing much during the regular season, but he hit the shot over Steph Curry. So, like, yeah, the slander can never touch him. To get back to what you brought up,
Sam, on that. I mean, I know it's not the same. It's totally different. But you saw that, like, as soon as they changed the summer league structure of how the games were played, people started caring more about it, even though it's, you know, the Raptors light with, like, you know, two D-leaguers or, I don't know, six D-leaguers and their first round draft pick. Just changing it into a tournament structure made it more interesting. So, again, I don't know if it's going to work, but I think it's something that the NBA loves to tinker with rules, with things like that. Adam Silver has always been a guy who likes to experiment. So, hey, why not?
Yeah, well, a tournament, as long as you're making guys go head-to-head, teams go head-to-head, there's always the potential to invoke the tribalism from each fan base. Invoking the tribalism always gets people amped up, and generally amped up fans watch and spend money, and it would probably be good for the league. I think I agree with both you guys on that the Premier League format is probably healthier long-term. And that'll bring up another topic, but one that we're going to leave. First, I do want to talk about the financials that you brought up and how it impacted the rumor mill, but rather let's talk about how it impacts team building in the Premier League, let's say, against the NBA. What is the biggest contrast between the financial fair play that rules the NBA and that seemingly doesn't have a grip on anything in the Premier League? And we'll go to Tussin for this first.
You kind of can build your squad out. If you're smart enough, you can build your squad out for a longer time. Like, for example, with, you know, let's say the Warriors want to keep KD and they didn't have to worry about the salary cap. Like, they literally could shell out whatever money they wanted to and just keep running it back. They literally could have had that same squad and just kept running it back, and they could have got whoever they want. Like, with, you know, I wouldn't say, for example, Man United, we have a lot of money, but we don't spend the money correctly. We spent almost £1 billion, you know, in the last, like, 10 years not correctly. So it's like, you can literally build your whole squad out, you know, to continue to dominate. I mean, that's what, but if you it's the same thing with NBA. It's like, if you, you know, you have to know how to spend your money correctly. You know, you have to properly, like, balance your squad and have the right amount of, like, squad players, the right amount of talent, you know? So it's literally the same thing, except that with soccer, you just have, you know, if depending on who your team is, you have enough money to just do whatever the hell you want, in a sense.
And what do you think, Sarar?
I think it definitely, you need to be much shrewder in the NBA or in any salary cap league to build a team. And you almost always have to take a long-term view, and the decisions you make every summer or, you know, stay with you. Like, you can't just, like, write them off. Like, if you sign Chris Paul to a, you know, bazillion dollar deal, well, you know, you're going to have to live with it, and you're going to have to get rid of him. You're going to have to, like, give away draft picks. So there are consequences of bad decisions. In soccer, they may not necessarily be the same consequences. You can afford to get a player for $35 million and just write him off and move on to the next one. But even in soccer, even in football, I think you always have to look at what type of club you are. And broadly speaking, there are, like, two or three types of club. One, you know, as Tassin mentioned, you have the free spenders like Man U, PSG, Man City, who it doesn't really matter. They can, every summer, they could retool, they could buy. they could just reshuffle their roster because they have the money, right? And that's a luxury that some clubs have. Then you have clubs which, even though there is no salary cap, they have to operate under some strict financial constraints. So the best example that I can find really is Arsenal under Wenger for the last, I don't know, 15, 16 years before he left. They operated literally, they only spent what they earned. So unlike Man City and then some of the big oil teams, it wasn't just a blank check every time. It was like you had to, you know, sell people in the transfer window to get money so you could retool. Now, I think as more money has come into the Premier League, as the format has changed and money is split more evenly and the TV deals have gone up, even smaller clubs, you know, like Leicester, for example, or even Watford for that matter, West Ham, Everton, these teams can actually afford to spend more and be a little bit looser with the finances. So I think the way the NBA basically has been more or less the same throughout this period, whereas the Premier League, or even I don't know how Spanish football splits their money, but I think it's a little different. As more money has come in, teams have become more looser and less cautious in how they spend that money.
And when you're talking about having to be more shrewd in building a team in the NBA, is this what you think takes a team from trying to collect as many talented players as possible to where the game is becoming more commodified now, is that people are getting roles attached to them and these roles are worth a perceived amount of money? And there is that in soccer as well, but probably to a higher degree in basketball, it seems like. What do you think?
You mean like there's a reputational price attached to players?
Like the 3-and-D tag, the rim protector tag, the dive man tag. And I know there's like center defensive. You have like your 10, you have your 9, but
right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't honestly know if there's I mean there are always players who are considered very good at their position. I don't know if you can get away with being, you know, a defender who only knows how to head the ball. Like, I don't know, like, I don't think you can do that in soccer. Like if you have a single skill you're really good at as a defender, I don't think that's enough for you to stick in the game, at least in the starting capacity. I'm wondering what Tosin thinks of that.
Well, actually, Tosin, I want to kind of rephrase this and then get a second part on when you answer it. So keeping in mind what we were just talking about, but also this as well. So oftentimes announcers and pundits will use buzzwords to describe African players in soccer, like pacey, strong, physical, things like that. Is there anything similar to that in the NBA? And since we're talking about 3-and-D, rim protector, keep in mind what Zarar answered, but also that afterwards, please.
No. I feel like in the NBA is different because the NBA understands this culture. Like the NBA, like, and that's something like, you know, I work in advertising. There's one thing I've always said about the NBA versus every other league. The NBA knows how to market towards its core fan base. Like, the NBA knows who are the main players in the league. I didn't know exactly what to say to the players and not what to say to the players. Like versus soccer, like you have somebody can, you know, they'll slightly say something crazy. And that's because there's not enough people like of the culture or like, you know, trying to cover the sport, which is part of why we created our show. Because again, like there's not really that much people that understand the culture of how a lot of these soccer players grew up. Which is why, like, you know, you have these rumors and people believe how certain players are, but it's like you don't understand how they are, how they grew up. And you said as far as the, like a specific trait soccer players have. I mean, there are some players who are, like, good at one thing and they get signed, but, like, eventually they're going to have to, you know, they're going to have to learn how to become a much better player because that's how you get left behind. I mean, look at Kante, for example. When he first joined Leicester, he was just kind of like this, you know, just a ball winner. And now he's like, his game has changed so much. So you have to consistently adapt yourself in soccer and like, you know, re-evolve and all these different things, because if you don't, you're going to get left behind.
And there may be certain types of players, but they're, I don't think they're necessarily tied to a country. So like the central defender role, the engine room role, like guys like Paul Scholes, Matic, Vieira, Parler, they were all guys who were just bruisers, right? Guys who, like, if you were going up against, you knew that you were going to have a bad time that day. And they were physical, they were strong, but at the same time they also had a lot of skill, right? The thing most people don't know about Paul Scholes is that Paul Scholes, he was a guy who just everybody hated playing against because he was a arguably a very dirty player, need you in the back, but at the same time he also had skill. So there will always be that type of player that fits a certain mold, kind of like I'm trying to think of an NBA comparison for. I don't know, man. It's like somebody who just like a Draymond Green type player. I don't know.
Yeah, like Draymond's an ass, but like he's one of those players that you hate to play against, but you love to play with him.
Exactly. Yeah. So they're definitely that. And then you have like some of the flakier forwards. Like Mesut Ozil comes to mind. High talent, but doesn't do enough in other areas of the game. So there's definitely categorizations of players, but I just don't think it's ever been tied to a particular place in the world. I always hear things like, I guess you always hear things like, oh man, this this Latin American player with high skill. But I think over the course of time that has proven out to be more or less not really true.
Yeah.
Tosin, to get back to what you said about the sly description of saying, pacey or strong, do you think that's a remnant of trying to elevate the mind and the brain of white players like a Jack Wilshere, who the type of skill he had on ball and his physical traits were emulated by so many players around the world. But since he's, a white English boy, he was propped up as something more. And describing African players as, say, just pacey and strong is robbing them of something that they can give to white players. Is that too much of me reading into that, or is that a remnant of racism?
A bit of both. I mean, like, what really is with soccer is, like, what you see is, like, and I've always said this, soccer is just the reflection of society. Literally, like, every country kind of has their, the way they view life, even though soccer is an escape from reality for a lot of people, when we watched it for 90 minutes, you're really escaping reality. But it comes up, like, in Italy, for example, like, that's how, not to, I know some people who might be Italian are going to say, oh, you might be wrong, but like, their background history comes out. Like, you can tell when a country is racist just from like the way their media covers it or the way like their announcers speak about players. It's just literally the culture that's in that country that comes out. And obviously a lot of times they don't intentionally mean to be like that, but it's just so ingrained into them that they don't know any better. They just know that that's all they know. And it sucks, but it is just the reality of what it is. And that's why, I feel that's why more independent media needs to come out more in the soccer culture. Like, that's why we need different, brands and different people coming out to just kind of not denounce in a sense, but, like, just give a different perspective. Because there's only one sort of perspective. And you kind of see what denounces and, like, the people who are in charge of the sport in a sense.
And is there a specific example? Like you said, the NBA understands their players and how to speak to their players and fans better. Is there an example of that? One big example?
Yeah, I mean, look at the dress code. I mean, obviously when David Stern first did that, I mean, we all knew why he did that. It's because of AI and like all of that. But like now, you can even see in the way the commercials are set. You can see in the way that the, you can see in like the way that the, Adam Silver speaks to the players. You could just see in like the NBA is really generally trying their hardest to like relate to a different culture that, in previous times, they would never do that before, like, especially under David Stern. Like, David Stern, we all knew who David Stern was. Like, David Stern was, he was an ass. David Stern, like, he knew he was hated, and he did things like that just because, he can't. But with, like, Adam Silver's now, like, okay, how do we relate to this younger audience? You can see even with the music they play with the commercials and, like, the sponsorship the players get. They let them have more of a personality. I let them express themselves a lot more.
Yeah, Zarar, that makes me think about the player empowerment movement that is in the NBA right now. And what Tosin said was kind of like the grassroots, the beginning of letting the players grow their culture and the culture becoming intertwined with the game and what makes basketball so popular. What are the biggest similarities and differences between player empowerment in the NBA and then an example of maybe Neymar in soccer? What are the biggest differences and similarities?
Well, I think in football, there's always been significant player power just because you can pretty much demand you can actually request, have a transfer request submitted, and you not giving 100% or sitting out is almost considered acceptable. And fans may not think it's acceptable, but generally in the industry, it's like, if you don't want to play for the team, you don't play for the team. Like, the most recent example is from like 2 days ago, when Lauren Koscielny for Arsenal refused to come to the USA tour because he didn't want to, right? And the club released a statement saying he's not coming, and that's the end of that. Like, he's going to get shipped now. Like, that's how simple it is for a player to kind of, you know, say, I'm going out, and the club, now it's up to the club to get rid of him. I think in the NBA, you know, as soon as that news comes out in soccer, I mean, his value dips in the market, and people are not going to ship him or not going to pay too much for him. I think in basketball, players, teams, I should say, still retain greater control over the asset than in football, just because it goes back to the collective bargaining agreement and the rules that are in place. So I think NBA still has some ways to go to reach the player empowerment that you find in football. Now, if the NBA actually enforced its collusion rules that it has in place, then I think you would see that reduce a lot more. In soccer, I know there's a thing called tampering, but nobody even enforces it or even talks about it. In the NBA, they sometimes kind of enforce, collusion, like Doc Rivers got fined and all that. I feel how well that rule is enforced has a direct result on how much player power there is. That's kind of where I am with that.
Dustin, I'll swing this to you. Zarar laid out why soccer players have more agency, but do you think there's an example of why NBA players might have more agency in certain areas than soccer players?
Yeah, I mean, like, look at like how AD got traded. Like, AD didn't want to be there anymore. I mean, in the NFL, for example, if you try that, they'll send you to Buffalo. They don't care. The NBA now, like, I feel like players can like express themselves and say how they really feel. And I mean, look at Rich Paul. Rich Paul's an agent, right? Like, in soccer, it's kind of the same thing. We know who Mino Raiola is, and we know who Cristiano's agent is. But, like, Rich Paul has a whole SI cover. That's insane to me that, like, we now have agents, you know, as getting their own, you know, people know who Clutch Sports is. You know, there's a joke about Clutch Sports. It's like, now in the sport, you're starting to see more and more more and more individuals that just not only are in the NBA, but like, you know, even look at the way Masai spoke about, we never really see, you know, CEOs or like executives really like as a personality per se. And in the NBA now, it's like everyone's kind of their own personality. So it's just kind of nice to see that. I mean, the NBA has grown a lot from, especially when I first moved to America and watched soccer, you know, watch NBA. It's like, I've seen the league go from like this really so like rigid kind of league to like now everybody has their full-on expression.
I guess looking at it from more of a look at the franchises, I guess, is the NBA, it grows deeper and deeper each year, I think, anyway, and that means the player pool keeps getting deeper and deeper. Do you think that eventually becomes so vast that the league could support a secondary league and a relegation system like in the Premier League, for example? Or do you think that's too far away? Is the game too different? What do you think, Justin?
I would love to see it happen. I've said it a million times. I've tweeted that, like, I would love to see a team like the Bobcats get sent or the Knicks get sent away because they're just bad. Like, they just stink up the place. But I don't think it's going to happen just because just the way America is, like, you know, somebody's going to lose money. And once you mess with people's money, that's that for that. So it's not going to happen anytime soon. And yeah, it's just once you start messing with money, you're done with that.
What do you think, Sarar?
Yeah, man. I mean, I would love to happen. Been calling it for years now. Just because I think there's as much excitement at the bottom end of the table as there is at the top. But as you know, as Dustin said, it's the financials just don't work out. I mean, at the very least, you would have to, assuming you figure out all the ownership problems that come with it and the money that gets lost. I think you also have to figure out a way back. Like in this example, if the Knicks get punted out of the NBA and go to, like, I don't know, the NBA 2, I don't think that owner will be too happy with that unless it's more of a short-term exile from the top league, not a potentially permanent one. Because in football, like once you're out of the Premier League or the La Liga, like you're potentially gone forever, right? I mean, if you don't get better, like you're practically out. And I think that potentially out forever part is something I don't think any team would be cool with. Now what you could do, you could not necessarily, I mean, you could structure your I don't know, your maybe not add more teams, but within your 30 teams, change the format so that, you know, that's what the playoffs basically are. They kick out 14 teams and have a competition between the 16. Maybe you can play around with that where, you know, maybe a shorter season, you qualify for the playoffs early on and the rest of the teams do something, I don't know, do something else, compete for a secondary championship for the rest of the season. Something like that might, I'm just spitballing here. So, hey, I thought of something. So, season starts 30 games. You play, I don't know, 40 games to figure out who goes in the playoffs. The other 14 teams play a secondary competition. They're already out in January.
Well, I'll suggest something that probably would take a really long time, but would you maybe build from the bottom instead of removing from the top? Like, the big thing to make that happen, obviously, is that the secondary talent, the secondary market has to be raised considerably, right? And that's the whole thing about, there's such a bevy of talent and people willing to engage with and participate in the secondary market in England that they're allowed to have that happen. Do you think there's a way forward that you could even get a secondary market to that level? Like, the G League is obviously great. The Raptors, this is a Rapcast after all, the Raptors utilize the G League almost better than any other team. Is building up the G League, like they're saying, they're trying to get players to enter the G League straight out of high school. They're trying to support that. Is that the way forward rather than trying to instill some sort of FL championship? What do you think?
That certainly has a much longer time horizon. I mean, it's possible, but I mean, we're talking, you know, decades on that one until the G League gets to the point where somebody cares about it, right? So the first approach would be something more immediate and it would retain people's attention more. But the other one obviously is better just because in terms of player development, the talent is more spread out and you have more parity, I guess, but it just, the time horizon is just so long that it's insane.
Yeah. Well, I guess it would be, you just have to grant basketball the same amount of time to grow as soccer has had worldwide anyway, yeah. Hopefully. Yeah. To get into something that's a little bit simpler, a little bit more fun and out of the weeds, Tosin, I'll ask you this question.
Yeah.
The cleanest across sport comparisons between the NBA and the Premier League. It can be about play style. It can be about looks. We could talk about Eden Hazard and Kyle Lowry for the booty. Whatever you want it to be, man.
I literally was about to say that first. the first, honestly, like, and I've been thinking about this. I probably have to say Neymar and Kyrie almost are like eerily similar in a sense. Just in a sense that like they both left, like, you know, Messi and LeBron, and like, and they're both weird. Like, they're both really, really weird individuals, but they're so talented. But it's almost like as if they don't apply that talent and people get frustrated with them. So I feel like Neymar and Kyrie are really, really like eerily similar to me, at least.
Well, they're both mercurial figures and they seem to kind of nod their heads at, you know, the powers that be, and they just kind of deny whatever is happening. And like you said, both went away from Messi and LeBron, even though objectively those seemed like better situations for them to play in, and they left them to go try and find stardom that didn't come on the pitch or on the court, but certainly has followed them off the court, off the pitch. Zarar, what do you think?
I'm going to go with two. I'm going to go with Leicester and the Raptors. Like, you know, two teams that kind of came out of nowhere and won a title and surprised a lot of people. You can equate Kawhi to, I don't know, Vardy or Mahrez. And from an individual comparison, I'll go with Pop and Wenger, because I think both are, you know, obviously with the same team for 20 years or so, 20 plus years, success early on and then a big dry spell, very, you know, fundamental in their approach to team building and how the game should be played. I think those two kind of jump out at me pretty easily. And that's something that I've been mulling for quite some time.
Well, this is something you and I talked about on the Raptors Republic group chat some time ago. And I think it showed a bit of my ignorance as a soccer fan, because I asked immediately, I was like, well, has Arsenal ever won the Champions League? And well, not while it's been the Champions League, right? And that brings up something that's really interesting for me to talk about, is that I do share some of those ideals of that American vision of like, you have to win it all. That when I watch soccer, the Champions League is my favorite thing. But when I asked you in that group chat, like, what do you think is more important to win? The Premier League, the Champions League, or the NBA Finals? And you said the Premier League. How do you feel about that?
I just feel it's the toughest thing to win. That's why it feels so good to win it. It speaks of a sustained effort over months at a time. And that's why it's so enjoyable to win it, because you kind of live and die through the Premier League or any top European league, because every game matters. And, you know, starting in mid-August, you play, you know, we're playing Newcastle, and that game is equally as important as when we play, Everton later on in January. And I think when it almost builds up, like when it starts in August and, the tension rises around Christmas time, you know, then you have a bit of a, you know, winter congestion, and you get a little nervous there, and February comes along, and if you're an Arsenal fan, you choke. But generally speaking, like you keep caring about the care builds throughout the season. And if you finally win it, it just has a greater sense of accomplishment. The Champions League is an amazing competition. It's just that you can get hot and win it. You can't just get hot and win the Premier League. That's what adds a level of accomplishment to the Premier League that I think is missing in a tournament style format.
Tassin, what do you think? Obviously, because from my opinion, I love the idea. And yes, you can get hot and win it, but the Champions League is this hot-blooded, the best of Europe, Didier Drogba headers, like destiny goals and things like that. And you get to play against Ronaldo when he's in La Liga. You get to play against Zlatan when he's in, you know, Italy, and it's all these players, and it's a beautiful celebration. Like Zarar said, a wonderful competition. What do you think is the best of those three, the NBA Finals, the Champions League, and the Premier League?
I'm going to like be extra and say the World Cup is the best. but to like really answer your questions, the Champions League, not even close. I love the Premier League. Like, I love winning it. But like, I've seen United win the Champions League twice. And both times, like, you never get that feeling back. Like, that's such an amazing feeling to see your team win the Champions League. And it's just like, it's the pinnacle. It's like literally like, it's the best of the best in Europe, and literally you're the best on the continent. So, I mean, while winning the league is fun, again, like, I've seen this team literally win all three of, like, you know, the only team that's won a treble. So like, I'm happy to see that. But again, the Champions League is just, it's just indescribable. It's like, that is the pinnacle of it. Like, when my boys are Madrid fans, and when they won three in a row, like, you don't know how mad I was at them. Just like, you guys really have won three in a row, like, not just one, like, you've won three. So I think that the Champions League is it.
Ahead, Zarar.
So I think the Spanish example is a good one, because I totally see that from a Spanish perspective. I mean, in Spain, two teams win the Liga every year. So the Champions League means something very different in that competition than in Spain than it would in England.
Oh, that's a really good point, is that those leagues aren't as deep, so they have to look elsewhere to validate their super teams. Like Juve getting Ronaldo, trying to win the Champions League after they won the Serie A or Calcio A so many times. That's what you mean, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'll swing this back to you, Tassin. The Champions League, like Zarar said, is a team can get really hot and win it. They're in fantastic form. They go all the way. Ajax, something like that, right? But also, that's what makes it difficult. You play against those teams, even if you are one of the teams in great form, you have to play against those teams. It's also less games. It's a pressure cooker to compete in. That's the difficult part about it. But it's not as long, and there's not as many games to compete in as the Premier League. Yeah. So there's detractors on both sides. Which do you think is more difficult to achieve?
Champions League. Just because it's, first of all, to get into it in the first place is hard. Second of all, it's so many different factors that happen at one time. Like, you know, you could have a horrible ref one time. You could have something crazy just happen. So, you know, the Champions League is it's a gauntlet. And I'm kind of mad we're in Europa League this year because I just missed the Champions League, but it's that's just the competition. It's the one. That's all it is. So
it's interesting the way that everything pans out. Like you said, the Champions League, so much happens, and you have to vie for that. And the NBA is already, the NBA playoffs are kind of like a version of the Champions League in its own. And I guess, like you said, the Champions League is the hardest. Do you think is the World Cup harder? Is the World Cup easier? What do you think about that, Sam?
I think the World Cup is the hardest sporting competition. Like, there's nothing harder than the World Cup because it happens every 4 years. You know, sometimes you need luck for sure. I mean, like, I'm a huge fan. My favorite soccer player of all time is Brazilian Ronaldo. Like, no one to me is better than him ever. That's just my personal bias. But like in 98, for example, Romario got injured and the world got robbed of seeing Romario and Ronaldo. Brazil did all the way to get, they did very well all the, you know, that year they're supposed to win. And then all of a sudden, you know, Ronaldo got sick overnight. And it's like, holy hell, your best player, who's the best player in the world right now, just got sick overnight. And France ended up winning 3-1 or 4, whatever it was, 3 or 4-1, I think. And literally things like that, it's like there's so much drama within that. It's like, that's what makes it so much fun.
I mean, yeah, World Cup is very difficult to win. Like, so many things have to go right for your team to kind of win it. I mean, there's a massive qualification stage. Players retire, they come and go. You get summer injuries. You know, there's so many variables. There's so many things that have to go right that I think it does make the competition very difficult. And it's also very cyclical, right? Like you'll have a team that is going through like a youth rebuilding phase, and you know, like they're not going to make it to the World Cup for the next 4 years. Look at Italy last time, right? I mean, so yeah, I fully agree. Of all the football competitions out there, for a team to win the World Cup, there's too many things that have to work out for that to happen. So I don't think it's even close.
I think that transitions into the last question I want to talk about before we answer some Twitter questions and pontificate on that. It's interesting that the NBA fandom, a lot of the time, because of super teams and how much control a single player has over what team wins the championship, that there's an inevitability that the Warriors were going to win or that the Heat were going to win. But that's never there in soccer, even during Spain's golden age, right? And teams have these golden eras, but they might not win everything. What do you think about the, like, soccer as a sport, all the different variables, and NBA basketball as a sport with, like, all the different variables? Is there any version where a soccer player can ever get as close to one single NBA player to controlling the tempo of a game? Have you ever seen it happen? Tosin, I'll give this to you first.
Like a player that you feel like literally he's just that dominant?
Like Iniesta with Barca in his prime, Busquets, Pirlo.
That whole Barcelona team, like with like that Pep Barcelona team with Messi and Xavi Iniesta and David Villa and Eto, they literally are that example. Like that's the only one. Like that's it. That team was just literally just a bunch of freaks. Like, I don't know what else to say about a team like that. Like, they legit were just a freak of nature, that whole entire team. There's nothing you could do about it. So,
what do you think about that, Zerar? Is that the team to you?
So I think there's definitely some players who just carry a team. And, you know, kind of like how Kobe carried the Lakers those years. I mean, Pirlo comes to mind. Like, a guy who can just control the tempo, the flow of the game, and not even leave the center circle. Iniesta is obviously a good example. Xavi is another one from that era. I think guys like Henri, who didn't even have time on the ball much, always were such a threat that you were always worried about them in the game. It just comes down to numbers, really. You know, one guy in 11 will make less impact than one guy in 5 sometimes. And that's just the math of it. But there definitely are players who can influence a game to a large degree. I mean, and also psychologically too. Like I look at somebody like Diego Costa for Chelsea. You know, he's a striker, doesn't get the ball that often, but just the amount of worry he causes. You know, 6 guys on the pitch when he's on has a direct influence on the game, and your entire formation shifts to accommodate for, you know, one or two players, or sometimes one player. Messi's an obvious example on the, you know, in Barca, where, you know, like, if you think Messi, you know, obviously he has a massive influence on how teams play him. So there's definitely that parallel to be drawn in the NBA and football. And just look at Kawhi, like in the Raptors run we had. I mean, how much attention did Milwaukee or Philly have to pay to him? And, you know, so definitely parallels to be drawn.
Sorry, go ahead, Sam.
I have one more example of that. Brazilian Ronaldo that I was just mentioning. If you search on YouTube, Ronaldo France defenders, go to the first video. I think it's World Cup 98 French team. They train for Brazil. They literally like have a bunch of like some of the best defenders of all time. It's Desailly, Thuram, a bunch of different players. And they're talking about him and how like just dominant he is as a force. Like you literally cannot, you'll see the video. It's like a minute, 20 seconds. And they literally just talk about how great this one player is and just how dominant of a force he is. I feel like, you know, I'm kind of blessed that I grew up in this generation of like, you know, watching the 90s and like the 2000s, like now the 20, you know, everything 2010. And like I say all the time, people don't realize how good like Brazilian Ronaldo was. Like he literally was just like a legit freak of nature till he tore his knee. Like he was 20 years old and he like won best player of the year. Like he was, I think he was 19 or 20 when he scored like 34 goals in Spain. So he literally was like just an one man wrecking machine until like, you know, he got injured. But he, like, you watch that video, you see how dominant one player is.
We'll go to Twitter questions now. Zarar, I'll give this one to you first, and it's from Mo at Motif04. Says, here's a wild one. Would the loan system work in the NBA? Function would be similar to the buyout market for teams gunning for the championship. What do you think?
I think that'd be amazing. I think it would add a level of variability to player movement that would be super exciting. Yes, that's a hard yes for me. Will it be implemented? I think it goes back to your player power question, because player power is increasing a little bit, so people might not be big fans of that. But I still feel that is, it's not ludicrous or out of the realm to think that a loan system could be implemented in NBA. I think guys who like let's take a Raptors example. Somebody like, I don't know, let's say Chris Boucher, for example, is somebody who, I don't know, let's say Norm Powell or somebody who might not be getting the time that he needs with the Raptors and might be discontent, could do a year somewhere and, you know, play for a championship team and get some experience there. And the championship team might be like, you know what, this is a rental player. We got a bit of a hole to fill. This works out. It works out for both teams. The Raptors might not be competing anyways. It's a trade that might work for everybody. So I think you can pair up teams that are looking to, you know, develop players and maybe don't have the capacity to develop them or whatever, or want to get some playoff experience there. I can totally see that happening, especially when teams taking a more shorter term view to winning a title. They may not care about the long-term outlook of where the team is in 5-6 years, or they may not care about player development as much, but they do care about getting a ring next year, and they might be willing to pay big money to rent a player.
Talking about the young guys, like you mentioned, Chris Boucher, a big part of the Raptors wanting to get their own D-League team at the time was that they weren't happy with how their players were being developed and the kind of jumbled systems where most teams didn't have a D-League team, so your young players got developed how they got developed, and you had little control. How do you think teams would engage? And still back to you, Zarar, how do you think teams would engage with that if they're loaning out a young player, but they weren't being developed the way they liked?
And I think that's what a loan system really is for, right? I mean, it's for getting professional experience in competitive environments. The D-League gives you experience, but it may not give you experience against like great players or heavy competition. Yeah, the talent level just isn't there. So it would kind of fill that gap. But I think this conversation has to be had in the context of definitely teams taking a shorter view, like a shorter term approach to championship. Winning a championship. Like if you're OKC or whatever right now with their eight picks, you have no reason to loan out players to player, because first of all, you don't have any players. But second, if you want to build them, you can just play them in your with the OKC Thunder and you'll be fine. It's just cases where you don't have maybe the playing time to develop certain players, but you want them to, but that player could add something specific to another team where it might work. I just think the idea of player movement is adds more excitement. So that's why I'm a big fan of it.
Do you have anything to add to that, Tosin?
I just think it would just be a very interesting concept and to see how it worked, because I know how long systems work in football, but like to see it in the NBA would be something, to say the least. So
we have another question here from Fuzzy Slippers at AJCool16. And I'll go to you first, Tosin. Why are there way more late bloomers in the NBA than football?
That is a really good question. I think there's more, I feel like players just kind of get around more a little bit more in NBA, and then players can randomly get hot as far as their talent level. Like, for example, like a lot of people gave up on, what's his name? I'm trying to think of
his name.
No. They gave up on, D'Angelo Russell. Like, people wrote him off. I look how well he's playing. So it's like with the NBA, there's a little bit more like of a curve. The soccer, like, you know, these players, for example, Marcus Rashford, he just turned 21. I'm already seeing people say, oh, well, he's not that good. I'm like, he's literally 21. Like, that's weird. But there's such a short like lifespan in soccer, because there's someone else coming up in your position. You know, look at, there's a kid that we had years ago, Federico Makeda. You know, Makeda, we thought he was going to do the next big thing. Now at 25, 26, he's a journeyman. So it's just like, it's just with soccer, there's just so many different options and like so many more, you know, it's just tough. It's just such a more difficult environment.
Well, it seems like there's an equal amount, to me anyway, it seems like there's an equal amount of Jeremy Lin's as there is Jamie Vardy's. What, Zerar, what do you think is an example of, like, why there is more late bloomers in the NBA than football? Is that talking about Pascal Siakam? Is that talking about Buddy Hield? Things like that?
I think in soccer, players get bloodied a lot earlier. So if you're a, you know, you made the comment about the youth system. I mean, there are professional systems starting at age, you know, 12 for big clubs or for any club. And you get tested very, very early in your career. You know, by the time you are 17, you've already played, you know, a lot of games in a professional, but a semi-professional setting where you're wearing a big club's t-shirt and you're playing under 17 games, and you're a lot of your skill is tested early, and whether you're good or not shines through very early in football. Maybe the NBA, in basketball, you know, not everybody gets to play college basketball in Division I. A lot of the times, player can slip through the cracks because nobody saw them, just because there's so many of them. And there isn't like a real, really great system which picks up players at age 9, really, and builds them through and monitors them through. So there are a lot more surprises because players just slip through the cracks. In football, I don't think it's more difficult to slip through the cracks because everybody's watching. There are systems in place where, you know, player movement and players are tracked, and players are also scouted much more thoroughly, I think, in football. So there's less chance of like players slipping through and becoming surprises like Pascal Siakam, because they would have been caught early in the under 15, under 17, or under 9, or whatever, under 21 leagues.
Maybe to swing this back, and this isn't the direct question, but it's something I've seen Tosin talk about on the timeline quite a few times, is if the U.S. was putting their best athletes in soccer, they would dominate soccer worldwide. And also keep in mind what Zerar just said about how you can really figure out who's going to be a good player early, you can groom them, and less players fall through the cracks. Why do you think it's a fallacy that if the U.S. was putting their best athletes in soccer, that they would be the best in the world? What is wrong with that statement?
I'm so glad I finally have time to speak about it. Like, it's been burning me for years to to finally speak about it. And I hate the humble brag, but like I'm just gonna do it anyway. So I grew up, so I moved to America in 2001 and I played in the USU system over here. I played with some of like the best players that America's ever like had. My team won 3 nationals, my brother's team won 3 nationals, 3 or 4, my cousin's team won 2 or 3. So we're very, very like, you know, we're very, very like deep into the soccer youth system here in this country. And then on top of that, there's a kid on my brother's team now who's on the U.S. national team, Joe Zhao. He got his debut by Klopp in Dortmund, and he's on the U.S. national team. And we know another bunch of kids who got offered to Chelsea. One of my teammates trained with Man United for 2 or 3 months. So these are just people that I personally know. I know a kid also who played at Marseille. My brother, when they were 12, they went to Paris to go play against, you know, U16, U15 kids in the tournament in Paris. So for me, number one, it's very disrespectful to the kids that are trying over here in the first place to even say that, because there's a whole bunch of people that you don't even know how talented, how crazy talented these kids are in the first place. Second of all, it's like, you don't know how hard it is in this system. First of all, it's not like Europe where you can go to a Man United when you're 7 or 8 and just be groomed in the system. You have to pay so much every year in this country to play. That's number one. Number three is like, there's so much inside politics and like, you know, the coaches over here, for general speaking, there are some good coaches. I can give you stories, but I don't want to like go on forever. But there are so many coaches here that like don't really train the players. They just look more so to winning. Like our coach, my brother, cousin, and I, we had the same coach. He more so wanted us to win versus developing the players. And by the time, you know, you look at the 3 teams I just gave you as an example, my brother's team, my brother is probably one of 2 players that's professional now. My team, no one's professional. My cousin's team, there's probably 1 or 2 players. So it comes to a point where it's just like, what is it? Like, where is that drop off where like you have so much talented players that just fall by the wayside? And it's, for me, it's mostly like a system thing. It's like, you have to realize there are talented players in America. There's a bunch of talent. I mean, like the current USU20 team, which is why I hated people comparing the US women's team to the men's team, because you know, you have so many talented players. That whole U20 team that went to the Youth World Cup this year, they're really talented. You have like Tim Way, you have a bunch of different talents. So it's unfair to say that, you know, if our best players played, because A, you're disrespecting the sport of soccer, because that's a different type of athleticism you need to play. I mean, look how Luka Modric looks. Look how small Messi is, and look how small Iniesta and Xavi. Like, you have guys who are like 5'5", 5'6", who are arguably some of the best players that ever play. Maradona, for example, too. So it's just like, you don't have to be the biggest or strongest in the sport. You just really have to have a really ticking brain. I mean, Ocho Cinco, who is arguably one of the best wide receivers that ever played, he's played soccer, and he would tell you that, like, he struggled. Like, he struggled playing soccer. So it's mad disrespect to the sport. I think that's kind of what it is for me. It's like, you're disrespecting the sport, in a sense. And, yeah, like, you just have to realize there's a different type of athleticism, and there are talented players in America. It's just that, how does the system translate that talent into actual things? So it's a lot of, I mean, I could go on for days, like I said, but it's just, long story short, just don't disrespect the sport and just understand, like, it's a whole different talent, like a whole different sort of athleticism to play the sport.
I'll ask you one more question, and then Zerar, mm-hmm. feel free to jump in right after. What do you think has the most correlation to professional players? I know it's so hard with soccer. It's mm-hmm. not like basketball where you measure wingspan, vertical, things like that. What has the most correlation? What skill or trait has the most correlation to success and in professional soccer? Players in soccer?
Well, I personally feel like, especially when you get to a level of soccer, like everybody's talented at some point. Like everybody's really talented. What separates the best what separates the greatest from, like, you know, the good is A, mentality. Like, how bad do you want this? How bad do you really want to be great? Because, I mean, everybody, I mean, Zara can tell you, when Cristiano Ronaldo first joined Man United, he was a skinny, buck-toothed kid who just dribbled too much. And now he's arguably top 5 player to ever play the game. And that was just all his mentality. So, you know, that's a mentality aspect of it. It's a little bit of luck. Find the right move at the right time. I mean, and maximizing that window. I can give you a quick example from the Nigeria team. When Nigeria won the I think it was the U17 World Cup in 2015. We had 4 players who stood out. Chukwueze, Victor Osimhen, Kelly Shinquali, and Funchal. There's another kid. Four kids that stood out, right? Out of those four kids that's on the team, only two now on the Nigerian national team. The other two kids are struggling. Where that issue came off, it's not a lack of talent. It's more so of the right opportunity, and these players found the right team. So when you find that right team and right talent, it's literally just, okay, now you're in the right team. How do you maximize it, and how do you avoid injury, and how do you stay lucky? So it's just mentality and luck for me with soccer, because at the end of the day, a lot of these guys are really talented. It's just, how do you apply that talent? And how do you apply that, you know, that desire and drive to win?
Zerar?
It's so positionally dependent on what correlates. So one thing that I've always, you know, for forwards, I think the ability to create space when there is no space has always been something that if you're able to do that at a young age, and you got a defender on you, and you have something where you create maybe a yard of space when you're covered, I think that definitely bodes well for you. I think there are certain players, Pipo Inzaghi comes to mind, where they just have a knack of, it's almost like a rebounder in the NBA, knowing where how the ball will bounce off the rim. Like Dennis Rodman was amazing at that. He just, you know, he had it down, figured out, like, if the ball is shot from here, hits that rim, it'll probably go there. I think you look at some poachers in football, like Inzaghi, or maybe sometimes Aubameyang to a lesser degree.
Morata, who
just know where the ball will bounce at certain times. And that's born, that's not necessarily a particular, I mean, I guess it's not a physical skill, but they just read the game better, and they know what the probabilities are and where the ball might be. And that makes them great strikers or great poachers. Defensively, I don't know, man. I think, you know, being a central defender or a right winger is, I think, one of the hardest positions in all of sports. I'm always curious to know what signs early on give away a good central defender. I honestly don't. I can't tell. Or there's too many for me to name for it to be a unique sign.
That's one of the most interesting things to me. Just as somebody who came to soccer late as a fan, starting with Liverpool when they had Raheem Sterling and everybody souring on him, then him playing really well later on, not on that squad. And then there's contrasting that with the NBA, where it seems like talent and skill is almost undeniable. It's rarely about the position they're put in, because the guys usually transcend their own position. They transcend the situation they're in, and it's just, it's really, really evident who the very, very good players are.
I do want to throw in Chicharito in there. Like, he's always been one of my favorite players to watch, and a guy just who has a knack of knowing where he should be.
Yeah. And the last question is from our colleague, Zerar, Adam McQueen. Adam_McQueen says, why are Premier League teams obsessed with bringing back legends of the club to become managers? And which NBA legend would be the best fit to coach his former team? Zerar, we'll start with you.
Oh, man. Why did you have to start with me on this one? This is a tough question. I think, why are they? I just think there is loyalty runs deep in football. And I feel that when Wenger used to always say this, is that you know, you commit your life to football. It's not a job. It consumes you, and if something is going to consume you, it may as well be something you love. And I think maybe former players have an attachment to the club, and they're willing to kind of, you know, get too close to the fire, basically, and dedicate themselves to their former club, because there's a loyalty, there's an allegiance of sort. Maybe because of just the player movement in the NBA, that loyalty doesn't always exist. Although I mean, I can name you, like, you know, a lot of players who play for the same team. Maybe that's one of the things that I would guess. For the NBA former players to come back as a coach, I mean, that's really, really.
Is Dirk a good one?
Is Dirk a good coach? I don't know.
He's a good coach, but, like,
yeah,
is so he a prime candidate?
Like that's my thing. Like, I can name you a lot of players, but I just don't know how well they could coach. So one guy that I would always, I always wonder why he didn't come back as a coach, is John Stockton. John Stockton ran the pick and roll with Karl Malone for you know, years in Utah, 18 years. I don't know. I think it was something like that. And he was a point guard who just understood the game brilliantly. Like, if you watch any old Jazz games, you saw the Utah offense under Jerry Sloan, and it was like tick-tock clockwork, right? And you were like, this guy is just primed for coaching. But he just decided not to come back. And I think he is one guy that is one legend that I was surprised never coached, because I thought he, just watching him on the court, you thought that he could do it.
That was, and just on my own little tangent, I played, not for Gonzaga, but I played a bit of basketball at Gonzaga with David Stockton, John Stockton's son. And I learned how to run the pick and roll from that dude. And the way he taught it, like, it was so specific. Like, that's, you were amazing. Saying, John Stockton, he understood the game on such a level. And David Stockton basically parroted everything that John said. And, like, the way they run the pick and roll, those guys, is nuts. Yeah, it would have been cool to see John Stockton as coach. Tosin, who do you think?
The best NBA player to the former NBA player that would be a great coach.
Yeah,
I'm gonna go low hanging fruit, Jerry Stackhouse.
Yeah, that's a good one. He's almost there.
Yeah, I'm gonna go with Jerry Stackhouse. I think what he did, you know, with the 905 and the Grizzlies. I mean, I think he's on his way. I think Jerry, and plus, like, Jerry Stackhouse comes from, like, that old school era where, like, players talk back to him, he slapped the shit out of you. So, you know, Jerry Stackhouse is one of those old school guys who, like, you don't mess with Jerry Stackhouse. You don't mess with
that
him.
That was so, my favorite story about Jerry Stackhouse was that he had fish that would eat each other. Like, he had a fish tank, mm-hmm. and there was one fish who was all scarred, but he would eat the other fish, and he would just get new fish for that fish to eat, because he loved the dog in that fish.
Yeah.
Which is weird and a little inhumane, but I mean, you're talking about him being hard-nosed. That's the thing. And the first part of the question again, Tosin, why do you think Premier League teams are obsessed with bringing back legends to become the club managers?
Like I said, man, it's loyalty runs deep. I mean, like, when we hired Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, I mean, I know a lot of my United fans weren't too happy about it. You know, they weren't too happy about the whole ordeal. They wanted a different coach. And nostalgic in me wants Ole Gunnar Solskjaer to work. And I think that's also a bit of it, too. Is like, it's so romanticized. Like, they love that comeback story of, like, oh, yeah, come back. And, you know, it's almost like it's a boys club where, like, you've been here before so that you know it, in a sense.
Well, that makes sense. I feel really happy about where this conversation went and how it went. Zarar, before we go, is there anything you'd like to say to the listeners? Anything they should be reading or listening to?
Well, no, I don't. Rappers Republic, you should listen to. But other than that, Sam, I got some news for you, man. The other day, I took my kid to soccer, and there's a basketball court next to it. So, you know, I noticed a couple of guys were playing. So next time soccer happened, I got my shoes and my ball, and I'm like, let's have a game. And it was the first time I experienced what you had mentioned to me, you know, a couple of months earlier, where we played a game 3-on-3 where they were taking it up right after an offensive rebound after a rebound. They would not clear the ball. And I lost my mind. I was like, what are you guys? They're like, this is how it is. This is how it is. I was like, it hit the rim and you're just like basically scoring cheap baskets. So the way I changed their mentality was like, when I got a rebound off the rim, they expected me to go up. But I dribbled it back all the way out. I cleared it. And they're like, no, you can go up. I'm like, nah, man, that's cheap. But when I started doing that, they started emulating it. And I changed the rules of the game mid-game.
You're lucky, man. And Tosin, just to give you the background on that, I live in Mexico. And the way they play pickup in Mexico is an abomination to basketball. Everything is one. And you just go right up after the rebound. And they literally, I wrote an article about what the Mexican people here think of the Raptors. And they were just like, guards suck. Give it to the big guys. They're big. And that's how they play basketball down there. They're like, the three-point doesn't exist. As soon as you get a rebound, put it back up. Because tall people play basketball in Mexico. There's not that many short guys who are interested. They're playing other sports. So they just appeal to that. And yeah, like Zarar said, man, I wish, because I did the same thing. I dribbled it out, but all they do is they just yell at me. They just rapid Spanish. They're so upset. And I'm just like, I don't want to score like that. I feel like I'm not gaining anything. I'm not actually scoring the ball. I'm just doing a layup, which, you know, I don't even have to be playing a game. Nobody's playing defense on me.
They're going full. They're going full 90s basketball over there. Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, that's how they play. Tosin, anything? It could be a book you're interested in. It could be the Shirtless Plantain Show. What do you want to let the people know?
Obviously, listen to this podcast a lot more. That's what you first of all have to do. I'm gonna shamelessly plug my show. I mean, we're coming back. We're just kind of in a little bit of a hiatus right now because I just moved cities. So we're gonna be back though. We'll be back with more content. I'm excited to really like fully delve into like my creativity this year with soccer. There's gonna be a lot more things I want to start doing. So watch out for that in the fall.
And also, just to give you another plug, you recently wrote about Nigeria's team, the Super Eagles. That's on Medium. And if you go to his Twitter, which is Nigerian Scams with a lot of S's on the end, I'm sure you'll find it. That's
three
there
of
as
them.
Well. And he also, you wrote about an article I really liked, racism in football as well. I think that was like in April, but that was also really good.
Can I,
so if, go ahead.
I also have a question for Tosin at the end. It's your thoughts on Alex Iwobi.
I love Alex Iwobi. I would never hide that. I think the world of Alex Iwobi. I think that he needs to play centrally a lot more. I feel like a lot of people want to write him off, but he just turned 23, which is also what I've been saying about soccer fans. Like, soccer fans are so quick to get rid of young players and never let them fully develop. I still feel like Alex should eventually leave Arsenal and go to a team in maybe Spain or Germany, where he can, or Italy, where he can properly play in the middle of the field. But he's an Arsenal kid. Like, he grew up in the, like, you know, what we were saying, like, a lot of these kids grow up, you know, he's been at Arsenal since he was 6 or 7. So that loyalty was going to run deep in him. So, but I love him. I love Alex Iwobi. I think the world of him.
I think that's as good a place to end it as any. Zrar, Tosin, thank you so much for coming on, guys. I really appreciate your time.
No doubt. Thank you for having us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And to all the listeners, I hope you enjoyed it. It was a bit of a break from just the basketball monotony, and there's not that much going on in the league right now. Whether you're listening to this in the morning or at night, have a blessed day and goodbye.
Want to hear something amazing? Discover matches all the cash back you earn on your credit card at the end of your first year, automatically, dollar for dollar, with no limit on how much you can earn. Extra cash? Come on, how amazing is that? In fact, it's even more amazing when you realize all the places where Discover is accepted. 99% of places in the U.S. that take credit cards. So when it comes to Discover, get used to hearing yes more often. Learn more at discover.com/yes. 2020 Nielsen report. Limitations apply.
At the Home Depot, we improve things. This holiday season, we've improved Black Friday. Instead of one day of crazy, we've lowered prices now, and they'll stay low all season. From decorations to dishwashers, wreaths to ratchet sets. So sleep in. You're not going to miss Black Friday. Not one little bit. Black Friday improved. The best prices of the year already here at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. U.S. only while supplies last. See store for details.